Before I plunge into the presentation itself, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about my current Newton research project, just as a way of pointing a direction to where I'm going with my talk today. Now, as Dave mentioned, my training is in literary studies, particularly post-colonial African literature and cinema. And I wrote my doctoral thesis on narratives of urban youth and their struggles for social space in Nigerian video films. Of course, a number of you are now familiar with the booming video film industry in Nigeria, which was basically created by harebrained youth in Nigeria in the context of relentless social and economic decline in the late 1980s. That industry, which began as a bastard act by ingenious youth in Accra, Ghana, is now considered to be the third largest film industry in the world, producing at least 1,500 films every year and grossing at least $500 million annually. And some have argued that at least it employs close to 400,000 young chaps every year. Now, what I did in that project was to triangulate the connections between media globalization and the rise of new media cultures. And in sort of linking those two things, what I wanted to do was to show the ways in which the democratization of new media technology has opened up a third space in the sense in which Edward Soja has used that idea, in pointing to the ways in which digital technology now offers an alternative cultural space for young people to articulate their own concerns, struggles, fears, anxieties, and hopes about everyday life, something that is often attributed to African popular culture. In a sense, what I wanted to do in that project was to present a classic example of a prediction that had been made by the United Nations in the 1980s. In sort of considering the dramatic shift from the phenomenal economic prosperity and wealth that triggered initial moral panics and concerns about young people in the 1950s and the 1960s to the so-called stagflation and cruel scarcities of the 1970s and the 80s. UNESCO had predicted that in the more desperate structural crisis of the coming decade, the young may turn to the camera and the microphone in order to protest against the economic and social limitations impinging on their lives. They may be appealing to each other or their elders worldwide through demonstrations and cultural transformations for an ethical judgment from what one expert calls an all-seeing, all-knowing eye of global communication. So basically, I was showing how Nollywood is a classic example of this kind of cultural dynamic. Now, by the time I was done with the project, I left with a weird, which I, you know, defended and submitted to the Department of English and Film Studies in 2009. I left with a weird feeling that there was something not right about what I did. I thought there was something not right about drawing heavy conclusions about the lives of young people on account of mere representations in mediated text. And so I wanted to do a new project that would give me an opportunity to engage with young people in everyday life and see whether I can find out the same answers that I found through textual analysis. And so my current new project is entitled Reconstructing Identities in Precarious Times, the Politics of Youth Culture in Nigeria. And it's concerned primarily with two things: to critically investigate and assess the socioeconomic, political, and cultural conditions surrounding and shaping the lives of young people between the ages of 18 and 30 in three different areas in Nigeria. And then to identify and to document the survival strategies that young people have evolved as a way of responding to this challenges facing them. What I wanted to do was to point to a global dynamic in which young people all over the world, on account of globalization, post-modernity, blah, 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 are casting themselves as heroes and finding answers to problems in their daily lives. Basically, that's what I'm trying to do in this part. It is as part of this larger project that I'm going to talk to you today about this informal, artisanal, oil industry that has been involved by unemployed youth in the Niger Delta immediately after the armed insurgency that took place there between 2006 and 2009. So hopefully I hope I've set a context for my presentation today. As I go along, I'll stop by and explain some of the pictures that I'm showing. In the last decade and a half or so, a fairly substantial body of scholarly work has emerged, mostly in the field of Africanist political science, focusing squarely on identifying, tracking, and diagnosing the reasons for the chronic lack or slow pace of economic development and pervasive political crisis in Africa. Such efforts have resulted in a long list of unconventional political economic practices within the body politic of most African states, which have prevented the continent from rapid economic growth and political stability. These critiques point to a myriad of reverse practices in Africa, such as the privatization of governance and sovereignty, the instrumentalization of disorder, the criminalization of the state, and pervasive clientelism. Others include the ethnicization of politics, massive corruption, and generalized malfeasance, the informalization of governance and the economy, and many other such eccentric practices which have supposedly hindered the crystallization of genuine liberal democracy, economic prosperity, and the fast pace of modernization in Africa. Grounded in Eurocentric notions of the state and governance, these critiques does hint at the retraditionalization of political and economic systems in Africa, which have in turn consigned the continent to failure, poverty, and generalized development crisis. While the insights generated by Africanist political science in general have been helpful in apprehending the intricate web that is post-colonial governmentality in Africa, particularly from the 1970s onwards, much of the politics of everyday existence in Africa, especially as it relates to ordinary people on the streets, have only vaguely been explored. And the social consequences of the dominant problematizing rhetoric in Africanist political science are, in my estimation, twofold. First, much of what we now know of the African political economy is what doesn't work and why. We know very little of what works and how. Second, although the antics of African leaders in their quest for political power, wealth, and social status have been thoroughly unraveled by both political scientists and anthropologists, the everyday politics of survival by ordinary people in the midst of inauspicious socioeconomic and political conditions are rarely privileged. In other words, while we have a sense of the broad frame of what obtains at the higher level of politics and governance across the subcontinent, not much of what obtains at the micro level in everyday life is often known or even analyzed. The danger then is not only that African scholarship is somewhat passively complicit with popular Western journalism in stifling the everyday histories of ordinary people within its main study constituency, the politics of everyday existence, what Patrick Chabal describes as, quote, the micro picture of what individuals do daily to sustain and, if possible, better themselves and their families, especially amid the lingering idiocies of a corrupt and uncaring political leadership, is left unattended and unproblematized. Indeed, as Hetch and Simon have rightly noted, what often gets ignored in the dominant portrayal of chaos and failure in Africa, a quote, are the means by which Africans have learned to compensate for the impossibility of everyday lives. Yet, as a few scholars have begun to show, resilience, ingenuity and innovation, entrepreneurship and phenomenal endurance are all recurrent features in the daily lives of common people everywhere across the continent. While the state has consistently failed to provide basic functional infrastructure like good roads, pipeline water, education, healthcare, electricity, food and security of lives and property, there is ample evidence that people have found their own alternative routes in sustaining themselves and their families amidst egregious neglect by the state and its ruling elite. In Nigeria, for example, both in the rural and urban areas, there is now increasing indication that, quote, Nigerians tax themselves to provide their own parallel structures for water and power supply. The Nigerian people also maintain streets and highways, just as many communities provide their own security outfits. This list is endless, as even institutions like public primary and secondary schools, rickety as most have become, would have collapsed completely but for the efforts of communities through Parent Teachers Association. Other ethnographic research reports have also shown the independent entrepreneurial efforts of ordinary people in the areas of auto spare part manufacturing in places like Nnewi in southeastern Nigeria and the informal computer market in Ikeja, Lagos in the southwest. And the African youth, though not alone, are mostly at the center of these ordinary struggles. As post-colonial African states like Nigeria have become more concerned with protecting global capitalism and internal state power, young people are increasingly forced to invent new and alternative ways of establishing and maintaining what Finstrom has recently described as control and balance in their everyday lives. It is this aspect of micro individual struggles and strivings in everyday life, especially as pursued quietly by young people in rural Niger Delta creeks in Nigeria, that I seek to explore in this presentation. I am concerned to demonstrate how an ignored and forsaken youth generation in Niger Delta has stepped onto the platform of a modern day life beset by innumerable social and economic challenges to take charge of its own destiny and find answers to the relentless problems that confront their everyday lives, especially amidst unimaginable neglect by the Nigerian state and global corporate giants in the oil and gas sector. Specifically, I want to focus attention and reflect upon how young people in the oil-rich Niger Delta in Nigeria have developed an alternate underground oil economy in the form of small-scale private artisanal oil refineries, not only as a means of daily survival, but also as a counter-existential move against a thriving formal petroleum economy that has been cruel and indifferent to the daily predicaments, agitations, and cries of ordinary people in the oil-producing communities. The aim of my critique is not to unnecessarily celebrate young people's involvement with criminality. Rather, I want to demonstrate a particular example. A particular example of how the proliferation of the so-called shadow economy in Africa is, as Jim Ferguson has eloquently argued, not simply a silhouette of darkness and absence, but a haunting figure of resemblance, a shade that, through its uncanny combination of likeness, claims a connection, a relationship, and sometimes an aspirational quality. In other words, I want to show how marginalized youth in the Delta region have created a parallel underground economy in response to a formal global oil capitalism that exploited and ignored them for decades. What I seek to accomplish in this presentation then, to borrow from Michel Foucault, is the tracing of a historical knowledge of young people's struggles in contemporary Africa. Quote, a painstaking rediscovery of social struggles together with the root memory of their conflicts. Now, what I want to do in the second segment of my presentation is to provide a specific socioeconomic context for the emergence of this small-scale legal refineries. And in doing that, I've avoided the narrative already about the history of oil production and exploitation in the Niger Delta. All of that information is out there already. I've basically just focused on events immediately after the armed insurgency, just as a way of showing how this led to the small-scale illegal refineries. Now, the armed insurgency led by militant youth in the Niger Delta region between 2006 and 2009 had huge international and national political economic implications. At the global level, it fractured the steady production and flow of crude oil and oil profits to the international market, which, on account of the lingering crisis in the Middle East, depended heavily on Nigeria for over 40% of oil products. At the local level, it interrupted in very fundamental ways the accrual of significant economic rents earned by the Nigerian state from transnational oil corporations. Reports estimate that the Nigerian state lost approximately $100 billion between 2003 and 2008 alone because of a conflict triggered by youth in the Delta conflict, in the Delta creeks. At many levels then, the armed insurgency set up by youth in the Delta region had threatened to destabilize an already vulnerable global oil market on the one hand, and a fragile post-colonial Nigerian state on the other. It was in a desperate bid to restore industrial peace in the region, and hence uninterrupted production and flow of crude oil, oil profits, and economic rents to both local and international political and economic interests that the idea of a presidential amnesty for the over 50,000 young men and women involved in the armed insurgency was muted. Besides, it had become apparent that the so-called military option, ruthlessly waged by the Joint Military Task Force, a combined Army, Navy, Air Force, and police team created to police the region, was increasingly proving insufficient and inefficient for curbing violence and restoring industrial peace in the region. Following the report of the Technical Committee on the Niger Delta headed by Lido Miti, the respected leader of the Movement for the Emancipation of the Ogoni People, and 40 other members, the then president of Nigeria, late Umaru Musa Yar'Adua, presented to the Nigerian Council of State a proposal for a presidential pardon and rehabilitation program. The amnesty program was presented to and approved by the Federal Executive Council on the 25th of June 2009. President Yar'Adua thus announced an unconditional pardon to all persons directly or indirectly who directly or indirectly participated in the commission of offenses associated with militant activities in the region. By this proclamation, the president extended unconditional pardon to anyone linked to militant activities in the Delta, including those standing trial at the time, so long as such persons renounced militancy publicly and gave up their arsenal of weapons to the state. I took this picture in Boumadi in Delta State in 2011 when I went there. This was almost a year after amnesty had been granted, and young people were still submitting weapons, just to tell you the amount of stuff that was floating out there. And they got a lot of money, most of the money for these weapons, from oil bunkering, and I'll talk about this later. Accordingly, all militants were to disarm willingly, demobilize from their camps, and submit their entire weapons to designated centers in the 5 core oil-producing states in the region. The major commanders of the militant groups, such as, you know, Ateke Tom, Asare Dokubo, and the rest, all caved into pressure from local leaders to allow peace a chance, and thus submitted their catch of weapons to the Nigerian state in a sensational ceremony witnessed by both local and international media. Now, since then, a total of 20,192 ex-militants have gone through the DDRO program. Another list of about 6,166 ex-militants has also been drawn up for the second phase of the rehabilitation program, which is currently ongoing in Akodo, Ekpe, in Lagos State. The entire transformative phase of the amnesty program for the first phase of the ex-militants took place at the National Youth Service Orientation Camp at Obubura, Cross River State, from June 28, 2010 to late September 2011 in 17 different groups. So I went there to stay with this. At the time, there were about 600 and so ex-militants undergoing training at the camp. In August of 2010 and September of 2011, I spent extended time with some of the ex-militants at the NYC camp and witnessed the youth go through a two-week crash program on nonviolence organized by a private NGO called Foundation for Ethnic Harmony in Nigeria, led by one Mr. Allen Onyema, in conjunction with the Center for Nonviolence and Peace Studies of the University of Rhode Island, United States. At the end of 2 weeks training, the youth are awarded a diploma in nonviolence endorsed by the Emory State University. Apart from the training in nonviolence, the youth undergo paramilitary training, ostensibly to establish moral and social discipline, and engage in sports, music shows, and even cultural activities featuring Ijaw traditional dances and masquerade shows. As part of the amnesty package for the repentant militants, the process you'd also begin to receive a monthly stipend of 65,000 naira, which is about $400, as soon as they're done with the training at Obubura and continue to do so pending when they've completed their vocational training and secured wage jobs with the government or the private sector. A tiny fraction of the ex-militants who have successfully completed the transformative phase of the amnesty program have been sent to countries like South Africa, Russia, Malaysia, and all of that, where they're trained in mechanized farming, surface and undersea welding, piloting of small planes, and other such professions, especially those related to the oil and gas sector. In general, therefore, the amnesty has been successful in the sense that it has mitigated hostilities between the angry youth and the Nigerian armed forces and multinational oil corporations. But what has happened so far, Catherine Wajiaku, one of your own here, has argued, that is the replacement of one kind of economy, the economy of violence, with the economy of peace, where the Nigerian state and transnational oil corporations have literally bought peace in the Niger Delta in order to ensure smooth exploration and production of crude products. The fundamental structural problems that gave rise to the crisis in the region have not been addressed. When late Yar'Adua offered presidential amnesty to the young people in the Niger Delta in June, he declared that it was a national independence anniversary and vowed that his administration would do everything to ensure that the conditions that make people take arms against the nation and subject themselves to inhuman conditions in the creeks are ameliorated. But there is serious doubt as to whether the deep-seated problems that catalyzed the violent conflict in the Delta in the first place have really been addressed either by the Nigerian state or multinational oil corporations. Recent scholarship all points to the fact that apart from the momentary cessation of hostilities in the region, nothing has changed. The general prolonged culture of accumulation by disposition, where a larger percentage of the wealth generated from the natural resources extracted from the Delta region is controlled, managed, and used by outsiders for the sole benefit of the same outsiders, is ongoing in the region. The oil economy in the Delta is still an enclave industry operating without the consent and involvement of the oil-bearing communities. To date, oil communities enter and leave oil-bearing communities without their consent. Not only are the exploration and refining facilities prefabricated, dismountable, and relocatable, the Niger Delta people in general are still being made to feel that they lack the relevant skills needed for running a highly technical endeavor like the oil and gas industry. In fact, only recently, the current special advisor to the president in the Niger Delta affairs and chairman of the Presidential Amnesty Committee, Mr. Kingsley Kuku, complained bitterly about how oil companies in the region, instead of providing relevant training to the 3,000 ex-militants they selected for training as artisans in the oil and gas sector, were instead being trained as tailors, cobblers, and other menial jobs irrelevant to the oil sector. Oil companies still operate with impunity in the region, destroying the ecosystem, cultures, and health of people of the Delta through relentless gas flaring, oil pollution, and environmentally degrading industrial activities. At the national level, efforts to address the Niger Delta crisis have remained at best superficial and sporadic. Although the national revenue allocation formula had been reviewed in the 1999 constitution to allow for a paltry 13% for oil producing states, there is still no evidence that the said extra 13% has changed anything in the lives of the over 30 million people in the Delta region. In fact, as some school of thought has argued, the 13% derivation revenue formula has made, quote, a difference only to the bank accounts of politicians and not the lives of people in the Delta. In my three different research trips to the Delta region between June 2010 and February 2012, I have been shocked time and again by the dreadful social and economic conditions under which people live. There are no social services to speak of as such in the Niger Delta. Roads, electricity, healthcare, school, and other basic social amenities are either in absolute disrepair or completely non-existent. Apart from the main cities of Port Harcourt, Warri, Yenagoa, and Benin, where some semblance of development can be gleaned, the entire Delta region is completely enmeshed in squalor and debilitating poverty. I took these two pictures in a village called Oromokokwan. You can see that oil companies are constructing a road, but the road leads to a particular oil well. Now, directly opposite where this construction is going on, that's where you have people living. This is typical housing in the Delta, where I took this picture in Ibekobo, where I did my research. There are at least 60 to 70 oil wells in that community. And this is where the people live. I took this in 2011. I was on my way to one of the camps where these militants used to stay in the Ijaw-speaking part of Edo State. And we stopped by a village called Ekenwa. It's about 30 minutes outskirts of Benin. And this is the only source of drinking water they have. And you have oil companies drilling in this village.
how many people is that for?
Well, you, by just sheer extrapolation, you're looking at about a village of about 2,000, 1,500, 2,000 people. And this is the only source of drinking water. The amnesty program, begun in June 2010 to better the lives of the angry militants itself, has been marked by endless shenanigans. Many of the young men and women involved in the program have complained of exploitation and abuse by their own leaders. Apart from the huge security contracts, plump political appointments, and oil blocks awarded to some of the major commanders that led the armed insurgency to pacify and keep them from fomenting further violence in the region, there are still reports that some leaders extort substantial percentage of the monthly stipend of 65,000 naira paid to their foot soldiers. While the ex-militants were asked to open bank accounts where their monthly stipends could be paid indirectly by the amnesty office, those accounts are not being used in paying their salaries. Instead, stipends are paid to group commanders who in turn pay small amounts to their followers. In fact, there were reports about some ex-militants who have been attacked, injured, or even killed by their own leaders for daring to resist the extortion of their legitimate earnings from the amnesty program. The ex-militants who have completed the transformative phase of the program and have been lucky to be sent abroad are complaining of infrequent and sometimes incomplete payment of their $500 monthly allowance. I spoke to a particular chap in Russia, and he was telling me that for 4 months they've not been paid anything. Political elites from the region have hijacked the amnesty program, awarding overvalued and fake contracts to cronies for the training of the ex-militants in sometimes irrelevant careers. In fact, a particular case that happened recently, there's some people got a contract to take at least 20 boys for training in Poland, Australia, somewhere, and basically dumped the boys in Dubai. The amnesty office had to pay for flights to get them back home. Reports are rife of political slots wherein a large proportion of those currently undergoing the amnesty program aren't indeed those who endangered their lives by taking weapons against the state, but candidates or powerful politicians from the region. In some cases, as much as 250,000 naira, approximately $1,700, is paid to secure a spot in the amnesty program. Indeed, I myself have met scores of girls at the amnesty camp who told me that they had nothing to do with militancy, but were recommended by their senior friends or uncles with connections in high places to do the program so they could earn the 65,000 naira. The real young men and women whose sweat, blood and suffering brought attention to the plight of the region have been forsaken by the very people entrusted with the responsibility of improving their lives. Although an estimated 400 billion naira has been sunk into the amnesty program so far, there have been no palpable changes in the lives of a large number of those who took part in the armed struggle. It is this general sense of dispossession and alienation, combined with the persistent poverty, unemployment, infrastructural decay, chronic underdevelopment, and the skewed imbalance in the allocation of national resources in Nigeria, that has triggered a different kind of economy amongst marginalized youth. Excluded and forsaken by the Nigerian state, rebuffed and disparaged by oil companies, exploited by their own local political elites, and now betrayed by their own former commanders, a large segment of the youth in the Delta region have turned to the same industry and local resources responsible for their own abjection, that's crude oil, to find answers to the everyday social and economic hardships confronting them and their families. As Gabriel Apoemi, a 21-year-old boy, told me in the creeks, there are no other options of survival here apart from the local refineries. Look at this, our local river. If you set nets here, even for 2 to 3 weeks, you may not even catch a small quantity of fish to cook. So it is only through these refineries that we can survive in this place. Although Gabriel lives in worry because there are no jobs opportunity, there are no jobs in the city, he has to return to the village to help his father in the local refinery business. The illegal refineries does now provide the only means for the likes of Gabriel to cope while they await to get gainful employment or even admission into the university or any formal training. What I'm going to do now is to describe to you where I did this particular research and to give you a sense of how the structure of the industry, its economy, and how it works. And then in the next segment, I'll talk about how these young people rationalize this industry as sort of as a counter move against the state. Although the illegal refining of diesel, petrol, and kerosene is now a dominant economic activity involving 60% of the unemployed youth in the core oil-producing states in the Niger Delta, most of the research work for this paper was done in Bekobo, a small fishing community in Brutu local government in Delta State. I visited the area twice, in September of 2011 and February of 2012. The only access to the area is by speedboat, which usually takes between 2 to 30 minutes. And anyone who's done research in the Niger Delta, and Dave and the other guys will attest it, traversing the region is quite a tricky adventure. Hence, access to the area took months of back and forth negotiation with research assistants, friends, and all-time school classmates. This is not to suggest that the Niger Delta is a dangerous place to visit. From my experience in the past year or so, the locals in the creeks are peace-loving people, very hospitable, and at times even overprotective. But decades of unsavory experiences with outside forces have made them generally mistrustful of strangers. With a population of about 2,000 to 3,000 people, Bekobo and the adjoining villages that form the Ogbolobiri Kingdom lie on the northern fringes of Brutu, about 5 nautical miles from Warri, the state capital and main hub of economic activities in Delta State. Brutu itself is one of the 25 local governments in Delta State, located on the coast of the Niger Delta on both sides of the Forcados River, one of the many channels of the River Niger, about 32 kilometers upstream from the Bight of Benin. You can see the Gulf of Guinea somewhere around there. And Bekobo is just somewhere there, not very far from Wari. So basically, if you move anything from here, diesel, kerosene, and all that, you just bring it here. And you have Russians, Americans, and people waiting right there to collect badges of crude oil from you. The dominant occupations among this predominantly Ijaw-speaking community are farming and fishing. There are also other minor subsistence economic activities such as sea diving for aquatic snails and periwinkles, logging and the sale of products like palm kernel and palm wine. But these long-established economic activities which have provided sustenance to local people have come under immense threat on account of the environmental depredations wrought by multinational oil corporations operating in the area. A recent research report published in the International Journal of Agricultural and Social Sciences conducted in Bekobo and Obotebe Creeks over a 12-month period in 2008 indicates high concentration of heavy metal in soft tissues of Egeria radiata, a freshwater clam that inhabits the lower reaches of most rivers in West Africa. Not only did the research indicate heavy concentration of metal in freshwater clams in the area, it also indicated that, quote, mean levels of lead, manganese, and cadmium were found to be higher than world standards. The immediate effects of these high levels of poisonous chemicals in the land and waters in Bekobo and its environs have been the destruction of plants and animals, making farming or fishing almost impossible. Local residents in the area told me that while they could boast of harvesting enough fish to sell and cater for their families in the 1960s and 1970s, it has become almost impossible to find fish even for domestic use since the 1980s because of ceaseless oil spills. Apart from the endless pollution of oil companies, Bekobo lacks even the most basic amenities like pipe-borne water, schools, hospitals, and electricity, not to talk of decent housing or good roads. My host, Mr. Felix, told me that local people have to be transported by boats to Warri if they become ill, even for minor health problems like malaria, and pregnant women often have to depend on traditional birth attendants to deliver their children. When I arrived in Bekobo, it was about 5 o'clock in the evening, and I saw a chap about 8 years rowing towards the river and was fetching water. So I asked my, what is this boy doing? Well, they're going to eat dinner and he's going to fetch drinking water. And that was the chap right there fetching water to drink. And one of the women there was so upset that he brought a pocket of water to me and said, wherever you're coming from, when you go back, tell them that this is what we drink. There is no source of drinking water in Bekobo, not even a borehole. So locals drink, bath, and cook with water from the tributary of River Niger running through the village, which is contaminated with mud, feces, dead bodies, and crude oil. Thus, the illegal refining of crude emerged as a major occupation amongst local communities because the sources of livelihood for people in the area have been wiped out by the activities of multinational oil corporations. Most people I spoke with in the creeks told me that illegal refining as an activity for youth, in fact, only began in late 2000, particularly soon after the armed insurgency in 2009. Many of the young men and women who were not integrated into the presidential amnesty program and found themselves jobless after the insurgency embraced illegal refining as the only way to make a living. In Bekobo, none of the youth in the area were included in the amnesty program. Most of the boys from the village were either killed during the insurgency, or those who survived the violence were scared of reprisals from government authorities and hence stayed away from the amnesty program. Those who dared to register for the program at all did not see their names in the official list of ex-militants invited to the Didiaro camp in Obubra. The underground oil economy in Bekoban and other such places in Delta Creeks thus surfaced as an uncoordinated and spontaneous response by local youth in the midst of very harsh social and economic circumstances. As one Honorable Dikesi Edonye told me in Bekobo, we've just learned how to use what we have to develop ourselves instead of dying in silence. Our communities are tired of being treated like slaves or children. Generally, the entire structure of the local refining business runs on an ad hoc basis, mostly by individual youth entrepreneurs, not the community. From the acquisition of crude oil products through the refining process itself to the marketing of the refined product, nothing is structured in the real sense of the word. And almost every aspect of the industry is artisanal in nature. It is essentially self-driven and requires very minimal advanced skills to work in the camps where the refineries operate. This is quite significant because it means that the new underground oil industry is amenable to the largely uneducated and unskilled youth in the Delta Creeks who have been deliberately kept out of the former oil and gas sector for years. Jobless youth from surrounding cities like Warri, Port Harcourt, Benin, and Ugeli are often recruited to work in the refineries, and the only skill required for them to be involved in the local refineries is knowledge of the indigenous technique of brewing gin, which is called Ogogoro. Local gin is often distilled from palm wine, a very popular alcoholic beverage tapped from palm trees. The local refineries are thus rooted in the age-old technology of gin distillation, which local communities have used for centuries. The only difference between the system of local distillation of gin and crude is the product. The mechanism is the same. Only the product has changed. Here we see a unique example of how a new generation is reinventing old technologies to address contemporary urgent needs in local communities overwhelmed by poverty, unemployment, and sordid social conditions created by internal political regimes and exogenous economic interests. The improvised mechanism used for local refining consists of an oven that generates fire for heating the crude, a cooling mechanism locally known as oporoko, which is used in regulating the temperature under which the crude is refined, and a reservoir for collecting the refined product, which comes out in the form of diesel, petrol, or kerosene. The oven used for refining fuel works in similar ways to those used in modern bakeries for making bread, for example. The ovens are usually powered using firewood and charcoal, and in some cases, bitumen, which is itself a byproduct of the refining process. So there's a recycling process here which makes the industry self-sustaining and economical in many ways. There's also a cooling system. Just one second, I just meet something. There's also a cooling system, usually a standby water pump, a large container with water mixed with washing detergents, which is used in case of outbursts of large fires, especially where there are no fire blankets. Each oven is interconnected with a network of pipes that allow raw crude to flow through the refining system to the large tanks that hold the final product, usually in the form of petrol, kerosene, or diesel. Typically, the product that comes out first from the tail end of the improvised refining system is the associated gas normally linked with crude products. these processes is imperative supposedly to purify the final product for safe public use. After the gas then comes fuel, which is petrol, and later diesel. In some cases, the associated gas is followed by kerosene and later diesel. The ovens are normally in different sizes, ranging from the ones that contain 2 drums to larger ones that take as many as 5 to 10 drums. Usually more established refining camps that have been in business for longer periods have larger ovens, while new entrants or women involved in the business use smaller ones. But whatever the size of the oven, characteristically, 2 drums of crude oil would produce 1 jerrycan, or 25 liters of petrol, 25 liters of kerosene, and 1 drum, that is 200 liters of diesel. And most camps, depending on their capabilities, would produce between 30 to 50 drums of diesel daily. And each drum of diesel, depending on the season, sells between 10 and 16,000 naira. So if you times 16,000 by 50 on a daily basis, and you times that by 30, you have a sense of what these people are making every month. Locals are generally quite reticent about the sources of crude used by the local refineries. This is perhaps because most of the refinery operators genuinely do not know the exact places where the crude oil is sourced from. But from informal discussion with many of the young men working in the refining camps, I could deduce that the crude is largely supplied by illegal bunkers. Illegal bunkering is a practice of stealing oil from government or oil company pipelines by very sophisticated rackets. The process involves tapping into a pipeline, filling plastic jerry cans with crude oil, and taking the oil away in speedboats to waiting barges, which in turn sell the oil to large ocean-going tankers, which then sell it to refineries in neighboring countries such as Ivory Coast at considerable profit. The current managing director of the Shell Petroleum Development Corporation of Nigeria, Mr. Mochiu Somonu, recently declared that this complex criminal enterprise presently costs Nigeria about $5 billion annually. It is a vast international oil racket in which locals only partake in a very small fraction of the loot. But with the rise of local refineries, an almost insatiable local demand has also emerged for the products from this complex underground oil business sustained by both local and international entrepreneurs. Although illegal bunkering began modestly in the 1990s, it expanded exponentially during the armed insurgency in the Delta region between 2003 and 2009, because this covert oil in crude oil was central to the popular revolt and in the region, particularly for the purchase of munitions. But after the insurgency, illegal bunkering and its associated businesses have remained the main sources of decent income for the mass of jobless youth in the creeks, including ex-contract staff of oil companies who have been laid off and now have to depend on the black market in illegal crude to survive. Illegal bunkering in the Delta Dolls represents a classic example of how the struggles of the urban poor can sometimes be, quote, surreptitiously offensive. That is how disenfranchised groups place a great deal of restraint upon the privileges of the dominant groups, allocating segments of their life chances, including capital, social goods, opportunity, autonomy, and thus power to themselves. And I take this quote from an article written by Osef Bayat entitled The Quiet Encroachment of the Ordinary. Approximately 120 drums of illegally bunkered crude are supplied to each of the refining camps in Bekobo at least twice each month, perhaps even more. And it is customary for the bunkers to pass the cost of settling soldiers and other security personnel along the waterways in the Delta Creeks to local refiners, who often pay anything between 5 and 7,000 naira per drum of crude. The price of the crude thus varies depending on how much the bunkers have incurred from the point of extraction to the point of delivery. Production within the local refineries is often regulated by demand, so there is usually higher demand for products during annual Christian celebrations like Christmas, Easter, or even local seasonal festivals like the New Yam Festival. The market for the locally refined crude is huge, extending from the far reaches of the Delta hinterland to the Sahel region. At the local level, both private and domestic and larger public social and economic activities are sustained by the products from the local refineries. For example, Almost all of the speed boats that crisscross the creeks, both commercial and private, more or less depend entirely on diesel or petrol purchased from the local refineries. In fact, right by the seashore in Warri, where passengers board boats for various destinations in the creeks across Delta State and beyond, are improvised filling stations right on top of the river selling bootleg petrol or diesel to boat operators. You can see that's a filling station there, right on top of the river. Given the fact that access to the creeks is only by sea transportation, one can only imagine how crucial the local refining industry has become to the lives of people in the region. It is the main oxygen that sustains local transportation in the area, especially when legally refined products imported from abroad or produced from the four state-owned Nigerian refineries are becoming increasingly expensive and difficult to come by. Although Bekobo, unlike many other parts of the Delta Creeks, is connected to the national electricity grid, it rarely receives supply of electricity and hence depends solely on cheap portable power generating plants imported from China for electricity. The refineries thus have become almost inevitable to the economy of daily life. This is a pub here, a local pub in the village where I was living. If you look somewhere here, that's a generator that supplies electricity. And you can see a satellite dish, so you can actually watch CNN inside that hut there. But beyond the local market, locally refined petrol and diesel find their way to international markets in places as far as the Sahel region. Most of the boys told me that their products are often meant for the ceaseless demand for diesel or petrol from northern Nigeria and other countries up north like Chad, Niger, and Sudan. Big boats and other barges often move large consignments of locally refined diesel at night to obscure or abandoned quays in Warri, Mbiama, or even as far afield as the Waziri Jetty in Apapa, Lagos, where they are ultimately siphoned into waiting tankers from northern Nigeria and later mixed with genuine products from the Nigerian Petroleum Corporation depots before being moved to the north or surrounding countries like Chad, Niger, or even Cameroon, where they are sold at cutthroat prices. The market for the locally refined products from the Delta is thus gigantic, sustained by a network of both formal and informal actors and providing jobs and income for more than two-thirds of the youth population in the creeks. Thus, when asked what they would do if government clamped down on the illegal refineries, many of the boys working in the camps told me there was no going back on the refining business until the government offered a viable alternative. Gabriel, one of the boys working in the refining camp, puts it this way. If they want to stop us, they should give us something else to do. The Niger Delta has been cheated for a long time. Dave, how am I doing for time?
Well, that's another
5 minutes. 5 minutes, shoot. Okay. Okay. I think I'm just going to jump. And I can discuss other things with...
Sure.
Let me just read the conclusion. I can discuss other things later. It is perhaps apparent by now that my presentation has been sustained primarily by the whole notion of the informal economy. But I have deployed the term mainly in relation to issues of both individual and collective subjectivity and agency, particularly how these cultural dynamics interconnect with each other in the desperate quest by young people for social belonging and citizenship in contemporary Nigeria. Originally coined by the British anthropologist Keith Hart in 1973 in a study of informal income opportunities in Accra, Ghana, the term informal economy is now often mobilized in referring to a constellation of varied and highly dispersed underground economic activities in the developing world that frequently operate outside of the circumference of state regulations, especially with regards to state taxes. In other words, the informal economy is seen as the antithesis of national capitalism. Variously described as shadow, invisible, twilight, or even dark economies, the informal sector encompasses an aggregate of extra-legal or beneath-the-radar marginal economic activities invented, run, and superintended over by peripheral and marginalized social groups exclusive of, but not completely detached from, the mainstream regulated economic sector. The key features of the informal economy are its ease of entry, reliance on indigenous resources, family ownership of enterprises, small-scale operations, labor-intensive and adaptive technology, skills acquired outside the formal school system, and unregulated and competitive markets. The African continent in general has been at the very center of the discourse of the informal economy, and precisely so because the onset of relentless neoliberal economic reform since the 1980s, globalizing processes and vicious structural adjustment programs between the 1980s and 1990s, combined with the increasing unwillingness or inability of most African states to cater for the basic social needs of their citizens, have forced many in urban spaces, particularly the bulging youth population, besiege African cities for jobs and better lives to seek alternative avenues of making a headway in life. As David Hetch and Malikalim Simon have noted, post-colonial regimes from Khartoum to Lagos have no idea how many people live in their metropolises, let alone with little or no employment of services, how millions survive. In their recent introduction of Book of Essays, Reconstituting the State in Africa, Peter Agbese and George Kay have observed how most states in sub-Saharan Africa have lost the social contract with their citizens, culminating in alienation and the rise of what Neil Smith describes elsewhere as satanic geographies. According to Agbese and Kay, most citizens in sub-Saharan Africa have, quote, no faith in their leaders, and they entertain no illusion that the state will address their concerns and material well-being anytime soon. Instead of acting as protectors and providers for their citizens, post-colonial African states now constitute, quote, a veritable danger to its own citizens, even when it does not pose a direct threat to its own citizens through violence, repression, incompetence, corruption, and inefficiency. It remains irrelevant to the needs of local people. It is this chronic indifference of the post-colonial African state, exacerbated by cruel and insensitive global economic forces, that have propelled ordinary people like women, youth, children, and dispossessed masses facing inexorable economic straits to look outside of the cells of state control and mainstream economic activities to manufacture hope with the raw materials of irony. And I refer to this as raw materials of irony because young people have died from this very venture. In fact, whole villages have been decimated on account of fire accidents resulting from this industry. In many ways, then, the informal sector in Africa is not necessarily that subversive, anti-development economic terrain that evades objective study and negates genuine efforts to improve the mainstream national economy in Africa, has been suggested by much essentialist African scholarship. In fact, as a number of new studies have begun to show, the informal sector is linked to, and indeed complements, the formal global economy in more ways than has been acknowledged in contemporary African scholarship. Indeed, as Kid Hart recently argued, to the extent that neoliberalism has succeeded in reducing state control, the world economy itself has become largely an informal zone. The crucial question at this stage then, as Kate Meagher has rightly noted, is not even the boundary between the official and the unofficial spheres, but the distinctive organizational dynamics and the power relations that characterize non-formal forms of order. Although the informal sector is often linked to the innocuous and frantic struggles by the desperate urban poor to eke out a living, non-mainstream economic activities by marginal individuals and groups can be fruitfully connected to political and economic struggles. Now no longer confined to the small-scale and survivalist activities of poor people, informal non-state economic actors are not automatically the passive or apolitical social weaklings that have been implied in extant literature on informality, but are also active sociopolitical agents that seek to reorder the power relations between them and dominant political forces. As Ilda Lindell argues, there are growing calls for looking upon local informal economic practices not merely as marginal, acted upon as manifestations of chaos and decay or deviations from a Western normative ideal, but as providing the basis for social economies from which a different kind of urbanism can be envisioned. Thank you very much. And perhaps I should just end with this quote here from Anna Arendt's book on Violet, which says, "This generation, trained like its predecessors in hardly anything but the various brands of my share of the pie social and economic theory, has taught us a lesson about manipulation, or rather its limits, which we would do well not to forget." Thank you very much.